The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 143.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, a good YouTube buddy of mine. He's got one of the best econ channels out there. His name is The Uneducated Economist, but he is very educated. You guys will see. Mr. Economist, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Well, thank you very much, George. That was a great intro. I loved it. Yeah, The Uneducated Economist. Yeah, it's quite the name, isn't it? You know, but I got the name just, you know, from studying the economies as a hobbyist, never had taken a class or gone to school for it. Just incredibly interested in the topics and yeah, love talking about it.
So. Yeah, but one thing that I really enjoy talking to you about is the housing market, and specifically because you work in the business on the side of the components of housing, and you see it right there every single day. You've worked in it in the industry for several years. So I just did a video the other day on the housing market and how the costs to build a home are going up significantly, especially in places like California, Oregon, where you're in Oregon, and in Washington. And now I know you're not in Portland, you're on the coast, close to Astoria, but from a standpoint of the lumber and all the components that go into a house, and I was really talking about the regulations and the restrictive building codes that make the land a lot more expensive. But from a standpoint of the lumber, let's just start there. What's happening with prices in every day with contractors, with lumber yards, with the people who are actually buying this stuff? What's happening to prices?
Yeah, prices have just exploded. They're off the charts, gone, you know, catastrophically high. And to kind of give you an example, it was at the beginning of the year we were selling. Now, to kind of give the viewers an idea where I come from, I work retail at a lumber yard and I do some contractor sales. Now, I don't do the packages where, you know, you come in to buy a house package. There's other guys outside contractor sales who handle that part of it. But when you come in to buy like doors, windows, sidings, you want to do a deck package or something like that, I'm the guy you come to get that material. And so I'm really right in the middle of it all. And at the beginning of the year,
is that when you buy the entire house, like as far as lumber for the entire house?
Yeah. So like, okay. So in a house package, for example, as a contractor, you want a steady flow of material going to the house, right? Okay. To the project. Okay. And so when you buy a house package, you're calling up and you're saying, hey, I need my floor package. I need my roof package. I need my, you know, and so you have all these, like, you know, you basically have all the material that it would take to build a house, but then it's segmented into different packages that get delivered as the houses, because you don't want, like, you know, windows sitting on the job while you're, you know, doing framing it until, you know, you're ready to install them. You don't really want them there.
Right.
So that's what I mean by the house packages. They're okay. Handling kind of like the bigger commercial end of things. And so when it comes to like both ends, like I handle retail and I handle contractor service. So I really get to see the both ends of the market of it. And at the beginning of the year, just to kind of give the viewers an example of what was happening with lumber prices, we were selling a 2x4/8 standard and better. 2x4 is the most common building material out there. When you go to a lumber yard and you ask for a 2x4, there's like, that's like the number one thing at a lumber yard.
Yeah.
And 8-footers are a very common length. So I kind of use that as a gauge to where lumber prices are headed to, because it's by far the most common piece. And we were selling those at a little over $3 a piece. I think it was like $3.28 at the beginning of the year. Right now we have those priced out at $8.63 a piece. And that is by far off the charts high. I mean, whoa. You know, when I talked to the owner of the company about this, I said, have you ever thought that you would see a 2x4/8 sell for $8.63? And he said, I thought when my kid, and his kid's still in high school, he's like 18 years old right now. He says, I thought when my kid was grandchildren, they'd be selling 2x4s for $8.63. He never thought that you would see prices this high ever. So it's
to put that into perspective for the average viewer, you're talking about a stud there, aren't you? A 2x4 by stud. And so for the layman that might not understand what we're talking about, I framed houses in high school. So so I know what a stud is. And a stud is when you're building a wall, an interior wall, you've got your top plate, you've got your bottom plate, and in between every, two feet, 2.5 feet, something like that, you're putting a stud.
16 inches.
Yeah, you're putting a 2x4 stud, and that's kind of just the building blocks of the entire house. So every single wall you have, at least interior wall, is going to be comprised of these 2x4 studs that you're talking about. So you can imagine if a builder is building an entire home, how many studs you'd actually, well, how many, do you know that right off the top of your head? Like a 2,000 square foot house, how many studs do you think they'd buy on average?
Well, I mean, when it comes to interior walls, you know, there's a lot of floor plans that would change it around. But I mean, a unit is not uncommon to send out, like a whole unit of 2x4s. And that would be like an extreme amount of 2x4s. That would include all the interior walls, you're blocking everything else that you would need.
How many?
And obviously you got plating material too. So when it comes to like, say, just the amount of studs that you would send out, I mean, anywhere from say 250 to 300.
Wow. And so their cost is going up by $5 per. So $5 times 300. So it's early in the morning here. Five. But that's going up by.
yeah, me too. Let's see. That's
1500
bucks. Yeah. $1,500 just for the studs, you know, and you consider that it used to be, well, if you go $900, but that's just for the studs. You also got to think you got all the plating material, you have all the exterior walls, you have all the beams, you have all the plywood itself. Okay. So sheathing, like, okay. So again, for your layman's, we were talking about the studs in the wall. That's like the skeleton of the building. And then you have the sheathing, which is like the skin that goes on the outside. And this is like the structure of the building. After that, all the rest of the components can vary. You know, you can get windows from a million different places, you know, different siding, doors. There's all kinds of different components that goes on to that structure. But that main structure, the studs and that sheathing, that's the same, regardless if you're building a, you know, 5,000 square foot home or a, you know, 32 square foot shack, you know, it's the same material. Right. It's just more of it. You know, everything else after that is different. So it's a really, the building components is really a good place to follow, especially that studs and sheathing. And the sheathing itself, okay, so when those prices dropped, I think we saw a low of around $1,650 on half-inch CDX 5-ply, which is, like I said, that sheathing, that skin. Right now, well, they peaked out at $3,650. A couple of weeks ago, right now we're selling them at $33 a sheet. Wow. So that's a little over doubled in price. And before that, the highest that I had ever seen CDX sell for was $26. So yeah, it was $10 a sheet higher than that. And there's a lot of sheathing that goes into a house. Again, you know, you got probably two units, 120 sheets or so. And yeah, so there's another $1,200 added onto the cost of just sheathing the place. So just studs and sheathing is an additional, you know, $3,000 or so.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking about massive, I mean, we're not talking about 10% increases in price, price increases like we saw in the 1970s. I mean, we're talking about like, as far as 2x4s, I mean, you're talking about 100, 200%, 300% increases in the prices of 2x4s. And I mean, these are big, big numbers. So how are the builders absorbing these costs? Are they having to raise prices or what are they having to do to get by to actually build more housing stock?
Well, at first people were real surprised by it. Like, you know, they, you know, are you sure? Can you double check? You know, is it going to come down? You know, why is it so high? Okay. I'm not sure exactly how a lot of these guys are handling, because once you put that bid out there and then you go to buy the material and the price is like, you know, that much higher. Like if we, you know, if you get a price from us, but you just call in and say, hey, how much is the price of a 2x4 selling right now? Right. I mean, that's not like a contracted bid. That's just you getting pricing.
Yeah. Right.
And a lot of people write these prices down. And then when customers call them up and say, hey, how much, they just kind of look at their list of prices that they got over the last week. prices had increased so fast that people were coming back going, oh my gosh, like I'm losing all my profit because the prices have doubled since I got my, you know, since I gave the people their bid 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And so that little area right there is probably very difficult for people to handle right now.
So it sounds like what's happening initially is the contractors are having to eat the additional cost, but next time they throw out that bid, obviously it's going to include the bid for the higher price, and therefore that would go to the builder, and then the builder would most likely pass that on to the consumer. I mean, a lot of the, what we're talking about in the channel, what you talk about and I talk about, is this debate between inflation and deflation. And this is rather anecdotal because we're just talking about one little section of billions and billions of prices. But boy, oh boy, it's sure going up in building costs. And then, but then I like to, although it is a very small segment, I think it's extremely important because most people's biggest expense is housing, whether they're buying the home or whether they're renting the home. And this would trickle down, if you will, I think, to obviously home prices, but also to rents for new building stock. I mean, these people, that they have to make money. And at the end of the day, they've got to squeeze out a margin. They're going to pass it on to the end consumer. So I'm sure you've thought about that quite a bit. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have thought about that because it seems that house packages are still going up. People are still buying and still building right now. And it kind of makes a lot of sense. I mean, I live kind of away from Portland a ways. And people are moving away from cities. They're getting away from the concentrated areas and trying to find their, you know, location out there in a little bit more rural area. So I can see a lot of building kind of happening where I wasn't expecting it to take place because I just feel that people are just leaving the city. You know, as far as the consumer ending up eating the cost of this lumber, I think about that quite a bit because, you know, when you're building a house, like, you don't really think about the cost of lumber. You just think about, like, okay, like if you were, like, you know, say the end purchase, like I'm going to take out a construction loan and build a home or something like that. All you're worried about is making the monthly payment. So regardless of what the cost of the material is, it doesn't really matter as long as you make that monthly payment and then get your end product. You know, that's the only thing you're really concerned about. So I think about, like, you know, how much people are paying for lumber right now, and then the added interest that goes on top of that. So how much are they actually really paying for those 2x4s? You know, I mean, when it's all said and done.
Right.
But my concern for those people is that once they get this house built, if the prices start to drop and the inventory levels start to rise, then the home prices come down. They're going to be stuck on a very expensively built home, you know, that it's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah. But how do prices come down? I mean, that's the question.
So, okay. Well, in my opinion on as far as house prices go and the construction prices, the lumber prices are far beyond what they should be right now. I mean, it's like an unrealistic price. I mean, the November contracts are up right now and they're around the low 600s, but the September contracts, which just closed, were at 900 per thousand. And 900 per thousand
contracts on lumber, right?
Yeah, we're talking about the future contracts on lumber prices. And so we just experienced 900 per thousand in the futures, but the November contract seems to be a little lower and it's actually come down from 800 per thousand. So I kind of see the lumber prices coming down come the new year. And once those prices start coming down and the houses begin to get cheaper to build, well, you know, then you can start adding more supply to the inventory that's out there. Now, whether it matches the demand, I mean, who knows about that? But, you know, I'm just thinking the capabilities of being able to build a house that's more affordable as these lumber prices come down will start to present themselves. At the same time, I'm also expecting that the forbearance that a lot of people have been in will come to an end, and that the foreclosures that should have been in the system that aren't in the system right now will start flooding in. You know, if you think about it, like, a lot of foreclosures that should be in the system right now, just from the simple fact that foreclosures happen. I mean, not everybody is going to be able to make it through their loan. Some people run into times where they just simply have to default on this thing. They can't do it. And they've been essentially masked over with all the forbearance. So these people aren't in the system where they should naturally be there. So when this whole forbearance thing ends, you know, you're not only going to have the people who should have been in foreclosure just because, but you're also going to have all the people who coming in who, you know, had to suffer through all the job losses.
And they can extend that forbearance for another 180 days. So
it's only going to make the problem worse. It's my big, you know.
Yeah. And then what happens from there? I mean, the Fed and the government both know that they cannot allow housing prices, or they might not have a choice, but they have to do everything in their power to prevent housing prices and asset prices in general from coming down, because so much of consumer spending is a result of higher and higher asset prices. You know what's interesting is I'm in Phoenix right now, and I've been here for maybe a couple weeks just trying to get situated. I'll be here for a couple months helping out a friend. But I've just been shocked at the amount of people that are out at like restaurants spending money. And because you think, okay, you've got a 10% unemployment rate to be optimistic. I think overly optimistic. Yeah, I think the numbers are cooked there, just like the CPI. But let's just say it's a 10% unemployment rate. That's huge. That's huge. I mean, that's GFC levels, right? And so you're expecting all these businesses to be empty, and the Whole Foods to be empty, and Trader Joe's and the restaurants and all these things. And you walk in there. I went out to dinner with my buddy the other night, and he's like, oh, yeah, we got to go to this taco place. It's great. It was in Chandler. We go there. It's packed. I mean, it's packed. The line's out the front door. And they're like, what's the wait? Like an hour wait. I'm like, you're kidding me. And this isn't on like a Friday or Saturday night. And then we go down the street to another taco place. That's packed. We go to another, like every single restaurant we go to is packed. And this is like Wednesday in Phoenix, Arizona. And I'm like, where are these people getting the money for this? Like I get it. They've all been locked up. So they want to go out and experience life and go to restaurants and stuff. But you still have to have the money, the income to do it. And then I went out Saturday night for the UFC thing. Same thing. You know, it started at 7 o'clock my time. I went out at 6:15, assuming that that's plenty of time to get a seat. No chance. Every place I went to, packed, line out the front door, a 2-hour wait just to get into the sports bar to watch the UFC. But again, I'm thinking, where are the people? And it might just be because home prices, I think maybe, and I'd love to get your opinion on this, are just going up and up and up so quickly, especially in these suburban areas, which is a lot of Phoenix, that these people are feeling more and more rich, and therefore they're just going out and spending everything they have because they're seeing their house price go up, assuming that that's their bank account. Well, do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah. I mean, that very well could be the wealth effect. It really does. It's a true thing. I mean, you know, whether people, it's funny when their portfolio goes down, they don't have the money. When the portfolio goes up, they do have the money, and they never cashed out or sold or anything on their portfolio. But all of a sudden now they have the money because they just feel like, you know, they can spend it because now all of a sudden their portfolio goes up. Same thing with their house prices. Yeah, that could be it. I honestly think that people were locked down, so scared and so tied up for so long that, you know, that pent up energy is just, you know, it's flowing through. I experienced the same thing on a Thursday. I was out at a Mexican restaurant, taco place, you know, myself, and same thing. I mean, hour and a half wait. I couldn't believe it. I mean, the place was hopping. I mean, it was people who came in, looked around, realized every seat was there. And I mean, we probably saw a dozen people show up to sit down that couldn't find a seat. I mean,
yeah. But I know last time we spoke, we talked about a lot of businesses there locally where you are actually shutting down. And a lot of your, I think one of your friends owned a restaurant that was like, listen, my margins just aren't high enough. If I have to run at 50 or 75% capacity or even in 90% capacity, I'm out of business. I can't survive that. So how are things looking on the ground where you are from a standpoint of the businesses being open? Are there fewer of those businesses? Maybe were able to come back online, or how's that working with your friends there in the local area and what you've experienced?
Kind of a mix of stuff. I mean, some of the people who are very determined you know, to keep their businesses up and running. I think they're doing okay. I see a lot of visitors to the area, you know, like 6 months ago, it was very quiet. There wasn't a whole lot of people coming around the area, no visitors, stuff like that. Now the weekends, the town fills up. There's a lot of traffic. There's a lot of income coming to these businesses from the tourist standpoint. So it's hard to tell right now exactly how successful these guys are going to be. Because, you know, once we go into winter and a lot of these people stop coming in every weekend, then it's probably going to start telling a different story about how, you know, how the distancing, the, you know, the limited seating, stuff like that is going to affect a lot of these businesses. But as of right now, when I go out, I see people in them. I see a lot of businesses happening and a lot of smiles on their faces when I talk to them. So it seems like things are going pretty good for them through the summer, in my opinion. Anyway.
See, but then it takes me back to trying to figure out how on earth these people are getting the money to go out to Astoria, which is a touristy place, and actually spend the money. I mean, everything that I see, like when I was in Fort Lauderdale the other day before I went to St. Bart's, I mean, half the businesses were shut down on like the main street in Fort Lauderdale. And that means a lot of jobs. And I mean, I don't know, maybe it's this thing that we have this economy that's completely segregated from the standpoint of these service sector jobs that might not have paid a lot of money. Those people are all unemployed, and that's the unemployment numbers that skew it very high. But maybe everyone else that wasn't in the service sector, maybe they're still employed. Maybe their businesses are booming, just like your lumber yard. And, you know, I went to Discount Tire the other day, and that place was going off. So, those guys haven't lost any of their jobs, I can tell you that. So maybe it's just the service industry have lost a lot of jobs. And those are kind of low paying jobs, more for unskilled, maybe younger people. And those people weren't spending money in the first place because they're living paycheck to paycheck. So those weren't the people that were going out to Astoria for the weekend. Maybe there's something to it. What do you think about that?
You know, and also, I mean, a lot of times, like, you know, those service sector jobs, like, you know, I know a lot of people who work two jobs. One being, you know, a bartender or a waitress or something like that. So a lot of those jobs are also like second jobs or night jobs, you know, for a lot of people. So, you know, that could be the case for a good number of them, you know. And, you know, there's, you know, I guess, like, you know, not to, you know, throw some like cold water on the whole thing. I mean, there are some like situations that keep coming up. Like, we have a seafood plant that just had 77 new cases, you know, and for our little county, that was huge, you know, to come in. So I don't know what's going to happen as far as like, if they're going to lock us down or, you know, shut the hotels down again or whatever, because of this massive, you know, COVID outbreak that we just all of a sudden experienced. I it doesn't seem to me to be something like that, but if they were to go and perform another lockdown or, you know, put any more restriction on it, I just, you know, I would see the unemployment numbers start kicking back up again, as, you know, as the businesses wouldn't be successful in being able to operate through that, something like that. I mean, that's what I see anyhow.
What are the restrictions where you are right now?
Pretty much just limited seating. You know, as far as that goes, they have like a lot more screens up. You can't sit at a bar, you know, you have to sit at a table.
Do you think that's maybe why it seems so packed? Maybe I'm not even seeing that. Maybe I'm just looking in the front door and seeing a huge line and being like, wow, this is just packed, when in reality they're packed because they only have 50% of the seats that they had before. Maybe I'm just not seeing the whole picture.
And half the staff or something, yeah. The few places that I went out to, I've only really experienced one time where I couldn't get a seat. That was like that Mexican restaurant the other night. There was another dining experience that I had to wait a half an hour, but that was.
But did they have all their seats though? Did they typically have?
Place, They didn't have all their seats up. No, there was limited seating. Couldn't sit at the bar.
See, maybe that's more too.
That's
maybe
probably that's, what it is. You know,
that's maybe that's what I'm. Now that I think it through, this is making a lot more sense. Maybe I'm just seeing the huge line and assuming that it's just packed, when in reality, although you can't get in, it's packed because they're not allowed to go over 25% capacity or something like that. Maybe that's kind of what we're seeing here.
Right.
What I'll need to do is
it would absorb all these people who are looking to go out. You know,
yeah.
They had full capacity.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, let's go back to the building prices here, because I think people are going to be fascinated by that. Everyone's interested in real estate for obvious reasons. They got to put a roof over their head. And a lot of people right now are maybe thinking about selling. A lot of people are thinking about buying. And you talked about those prices really spiking, but now you're seeing the futures contracts come down a bit. You think prices are going to come maybe back to reality at the turn of the year. But why did the prices spike in the first place?
Yeah, so this was a really interesting story. In fact, you know, we talked a little bit about this last time we had a conversation. And in fact, you know, I'm pretty sure that it was on that show, that interview that we did, that I talked about the pressure treated
become
in short supply. And I think we were the first ones to talk about that, because after that, I saw all kinds of news articles going across the nation talking about the shortage of pressure treated. So I'm pretty sure we were the first ones to talk about the shortage.
They're watching us, dude.
They're totally watching us. They know. They were like, man, these guys know it. All right. So what ended up happening with lumber prices is that during the lockdown, the mills out there took the thought that if everybody's locked down, we're going to have a lot of inventory buildup. Let's curtail development, drop our inventory levels since nobody's going to be buying, and wait for the whole lockdown to be over. We'll fire back up and start building the inventory levels back up. And that was kind of like the idea of it. So there was like this big mill curtailment that took place all across Canada and the United States. Everybody goes into lockdown. They get the stimulus check and they're sitting at home and they're thinking, you know what? I could use a new deck, fence, or something. Let's improve our surroundings since we're stuck here at the house. Let's just, you know, let's use the stimulus check to go off and, you know, maybe build raised gardens or whatever. Mm. So lumber yards being an essential business and like pretty much the only place you could go to spend your money, a lot of these people went out and started spending money on pressure treated lumber and lumber in general, and it zapped the inventory levels to nothing. Yeah.
So the demand didn't go down. It actually went up.
Yeah. So all of a sudden the mills found themselves like with inventory levels depleted. And now trying to fill that inventory again has been very difficult, because at the same time, as we were coming out of the lockdown, building had a backlog of projects that have been waiting to get into the system that have been sitting there stalled because of the lockdown, came flooding in at the same time. The projects who probably naturally would have started at that time were coming in at the same time. So all of a sudden there was a big demand right after a demand that they weren't expecting had taken place.
Right.
So there was like a double whammy that took place. The mills, they like, you know, you could fire up a mill and start producing all kinds of lumber. But the problem is that a lot of this lumber needs to be dried. So it has to go through a kiln, which means limited space and time. And you can't make that go any faster than what it takes. So there's like a bottlenecking taking place going through the kiln. Same thing with the pressure treated. The pressure treated companies did the same thing. They had dropped their inventories thinking that they were going to be sitting on a lot of inventory during the lockdown. That didn't happen. They zapped their inventory levels. They couldn't fill the supply again because now they have to treat all this lumber, and they have an extra weighted time because they have to not only dry the lumber, pressure treat it, which all takes time and limited space, but then they have to sit on it and wait before they can ship it because it's a hazardous material that travels down the highway if the chemical is dripping off the lumber. So they actually have to let it sit there and drip for like 2 weeks. And then they can ship it out onto the highway. So there's like this huge bottlenecking taking place through the processing of lumber. But that's not the only thing that's limiting the amount. And, you know, and when you have all this demand, people like, if you cannot get your hands on the lumber, you will pay any price. At one point, you know, this is like, you got to build the house. You will pay any price. It doesn't matter what it is at some points.
Yeah.
So this is all taking place and people are like, well, why don't the mills just fire up and just, you know, just pump out this lumber? Well, because of that bottlenecking that's taken place. But then the mills, they don't just produce lumber. I mean, the mills have more product to it than just lumber. They have pulp, they have, you know, bark, they have a lot of byproduct that's coming from the actual production of the lumber. Now, this is an interesting part because I had never thought about this until the other day. And when actually I got an email from a gentleman who told me to look at this, look at it from this perspective. And he said that because of this secondary product, this pulp, if they're sitting on a lot of this pulp and they can't get rid of it, then they can't keep producing, you know, their products, because that's part of their product they need to get rid of. China was a major buyer of that pulp. Like a 25% of the United States pulp went to China. Well, during these trade wars and everything, that got shut off. China used to buy a lot of our garbage too. And because they kind of cut back on a lot of that purchasing of our garbage, we've set up a lot of recycling here in the United States. So we started recycling a lot of paper, which has also taken a hit to the pulp industry for demand. Mm-hmm. So this pulp, right, from this from the sawmills is holding them back from buying from the, you know, from basically bringing in logs and sawing them up. Now, there's also a secondary thing to that, too, because the biomass that comes from logging, because like when you log, you can't just pull out all the saw logs and leave everything else. You got to take everything. It's like a clear cut. And if you don't have a buyer for all that biomass and that pulp and stuff, then it doesn't make it profitable to log the property. You see what's happening up there. So it's kind of like this weird, like a culmination of a lot of different things that are coming together that's caused these prices to really skyrocket. Now, as we work through the system, I'm seeing it start to take place where, you know, the supply chain is starting to open up, more products are starting to through. It's still tight, but it's happening. And like the order time, that was the one thing that really I noticed is starting to change, is that when you would place an order for like, say, a truckload of plywood, it would be 6 weeks out. You had to make sure that you ordered way ahead. Well, that order time is now coming closer. So now it's like, you know, 3 to 4 weeks out. Pretty soon it'll be 2 to 3. And then pretty soon you can order and get it that week. You know,
yeah.
When that happens, you know, the supply is filling in. The demand is going to be coming into winter at the same time. That's a slowdown in the building time. So I think things are going to correct themselves as we go into that timing. So that's kind of what I saw happening with those prices. So it was like just this bad timing, you know. It was and a bad decision by the mills. Like, it seemed like a right decision at the time, but it was actually the wrong decision to make to curtail that development.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Well, it's a classic example of a supply shock. The temporary supply shock. It's just, and what's great about just talking it through here for the viewer or the listener is this is what's going on with just lumber or 2x4s, but this can, think about how complex the economy is when this could be happening with everything. It could be happening with food at the local grocery store. It could be happening with car supplies. It could be happening with those tires that I bought the other day. I mean, everything across the economy, there, it's this complex. It's that we go to a Home Depot or your lumberyard and we see the 2x4s sitting on the shelf and we just say, oh, pretty easy. They just ordered some 2x4s, marked up the price a little bit, and I'm here buying them. But we don't understand that there's so many things that actually went into just getting that 2x4 sitting right there on the shelf, and then so many byproducts of that. And it goes back to the you know, the pencil example that Milton Friedman always used to use. So next time you're thinking through kind of a tops down or a bottoms up approach to the economy, whether it's someone arguing for, you know, free market capitalism, or maybe someone arguing for a more of a socialist approach or Marxist approach where the government, we have these central planners. Just go back to this episode where I'm talking to the uneducated economist about 2x4s and think about how well the government could manage this process that we're talking about right now. I mean, there's just no chance.
You know, something interesting that I've been trying to read a little bit more up on that I can't seem to find a lot of information on. I found one news article coming that talked about the topic, but I didn't realize this, but Oregon timberland has been purchased up, like the private land here has a huge Wall Street influence into it now. Mm. And it's something that I saw the effects of it, but didn't quite know what was going on until I read this article and started kind of thinking about it a little bit more. But the majority of the logging that takes place here in Oregon is done on private land. And prior to, say, like 10, 15 years ago, most of this private land and the logging that took place benefited the communities from it. Like they would tax, you know, they'd have this severance tax and the taxes would go to the, you know, the schools and the library, you know, and help the communities out. And, you know, there was a lot of small mills and stuff like that that were here in Oregon. As the Wall Street real estate investment people started coming in and buying up this private land, they started to streamline a lot of the logging process, like started doing a lot more aggressive logging. Mm-hmm. Then the lobbyists came in and started changing like the environmentalist laws, you know, the laws for environmental protection, that tax. So like a lot of these communities weren't getting the severance tax like they were getting when it was privately owned by, you know, the smaller hands.
Right.
And so now I'm looking at this thing and I'm thinking, man, we just had through all these fires. And I don't know, maybe it's just the conspiracy. I don't know, conspiracy mind of me, but I'm thinking all these fires and I'm wondering if these people are going to get like a tax, you know, or get an insurance claim for all this burnt up timber on their land and stuff like that, you know. And it's just like, you know, I kind of wonder about the, you know, where that money is going to end up flowing to, you know, because it's.
But also too, I think you bring up an interesting point where we see the end result of artificially low interest rates. And a lot of times, I think most people don't connect the dots in the sense that, you know, you're talking about the way things used to work maybe 15, 20 years ago, where it was much more kind of organic, that the it was locally owned and it kind of just worked and it functioned well. And then what happened is the Wall Street types, maybe private equity or who knows, came in and purchased up all this land. And now they're just maybe not treating it as well as the other people would have. But the other people sold to them because they're willing to pay these astronomical prices. And people, I think the layman would look at that and be like, oh, those stupid Wall Street guys and the private equity funds, you know, there's those greedy SOBs and yada, yada, yada. But they need to take it a step further and they need to ask themselves, okay, how do these quote unquote greedy Wall Street guys, how do they have the excess capital to come in there? And why would they be interested in lumber at all when they weren't interested in it 20 years ago? They weren't interested in it 30 or 40 years ago. Why all of a sudden now are they interested in lumber? And of course, as you know, the answer to that question is because the Fed comes in and drops interest rates down to zero, so they can't get a return anywhere else. So they got to go further out the risk curve. So it distorts the entire market because now these guys come in and this is the only place. They got to get so far outside of the box to try to figure out how they're going to create a return for their clients. And I'm not making excuses for these guys, but I'm saying let's not look at the symptoms. Let's look at the underlying cause of what's happening here, and that's artificially low interest rates from the Fed.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's one thing that I've, as I started studying economics and gone a lot further, like, I don't think about blame so much or like, you know, the way things should be. I try to look things more just the way they are. Right. Like, I don't blame those Wall Street guys for buying up and make, I mean, it's just, that's what they do. That's how they make their money. You know, I mean, yeah, I guess if I was on the other side of that, then, you know, I'd probably do it too. You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, it's just the way things are. You know, if you don't like it, you have to do something about that. You have to change the way you live, vote, do stuff like that. But, you know, it's not something that you say is something you get angry about or cause problem to. It's just, you know, it's just the situation that is, and you need to deal with it.
And you've got to expect that people are going to, they're incentivized, and people are going to act in their own best interest. I don't care who they are. And if that's the way they're going to make money, they're going to, it's almost, I think some would argue, especially economists would argue, that's a rational decision, what they're doing. We might not agree with it from an ethical standpoint, but if your objective is strictly profit to make money, then this is a rational decision. And then I guess the argument would be, well, we've got to change the system so it's not profit driven. But then we go back to what you're talking about with how complex it is just to get a 2x4 on the shelf. And that is a result of people pursuing their own self-interest and the free market. And we have to have a bottoms up approach to supplying all these goods and services, because that's the only way that we're able to enjoy the standard of living we have in the United States and have all these goods and services, is because those individuals making decisions for themselves. But let's circle back to the housing just for a moment, because before we started recording, we were talking about the builders. And I mean, you're talking to these guys and gals every single day, and you're talking to them about how it's very hard for them to build a home right now, not just because of material costs, but for the costs of the land, the regulations that they're having to deal with. And all these costs are going up. And as a result, the lots that you're seeing for new single family homes are decreasing in size, to the point where, last time I was in Portland a few years ago, I mean, the entire lot is basically the footprint of the foundation. I mean, that's it, you know. And they're having to build these, the house. Yeah, and some are like this narrow because they're having to sell so much, but they're having to build these homes that are a lot bigger and therefore a lot more expensive, because that's the only way that they can turn a profit. And I did a video on this Friday, but we talked about it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I've experienced this same thing, because I've asked the builders the exact same question. That I was just like, how come they don't build like these, you know, small single level ranch style homes for like, you know, the starter family, like the starter homes.
Exactly.
You know, thing, like, you know, just bust them out, cookie cutters. Like, I've been down to Southern California where you go through the, you know, those subdivisions where, you know, you got like four house plans that have reverse, you know, that are reverse, and every house is the same. They knock them out. And he says, because there's no money in it. You can't make any money when you build these lesser homes like that. And he says that you have to build the bigger homes in order to acquire the profit from that sale. He says between the like you said, the land pricing, the labor prices, you know, all the subcon, the permits, everything that goes into it. If you were to build a smaller, lesser expensive home, like a cheaper home, the profit that they would make on it would be so insignificant that it wouldn't be worth their time to try it. So they have to go for the biggest homes they can, you know?
Right.
And that's just unfortunate. It's just like, so there is no, I guess there's no incentive to build cheaper homes if you can't profit from it.
Yeah. And it should be obvious that when we look around and you hear all these politicians and the media comes out and bashes the builders for not creating affordable housing, quote unquote, it's not because these guys are just jerks and they hate the poor and they hate the middle class and like, oh, I could make a boatload of money over there, but I'm not going to do it because I hate those poor people. They don't deserve to have houses. You know, it's not like they're saying this. They're doing it. They're telling us that, hey, we just cannot make a profit unless we build these McMansions. So this is all the supply that's going to come online. And how do you see that playing out? I kind of walked through the thought process in my video. And how do you see it playing out long term?
Well, long term, I kind of look at anything that seems to have gone to an extreme as a point of reversal, as some, you know, like, you know, nothing goes up forever, nothing goes down forever. And so when you see things like peaking out, when they get to the highest price you've ever seen, when people are saying, oh my God, I can't believe it's this high, well, that's when you start to think, okay, well, things are probably going to start turning, you know, and going the other way. And that's kind of what I think is going to start happening with a lot of this lumber. Now, coming down to affordable building again.
Yeah. Like the 1,500 square foot ranch.
That is so far from where we are right now, as far as building goes, that it would take something very drastic and significant to happen in order for that availability to come up. Like, I don't even know what it would be. I mean, it would definitely have to be a drop in land prices and permits, and I just don't see land prices coming down much. Permitting could come down, you know, some of the regulations as far as dealing with that goes. Labor costs are just going to stay high. The only thing that I could really see coming down would be a lot of the lumber prices. And I could see lumber prices coming down and coming down significantly. I don't think it could actually bring the prices down to the point that it would make that ranch style home affordable again. The only way I could see those ranch style homes coming up into existence is if people started building them for themselves. Like, if you could come across a good property that you liked and you know, were able to construct the house yourself, whether you subcontracted out the work or, you know, was able to be in the middle of it. With the low interest rates, you know, if we could get material costs down, then, you know, maybe that could be an option for people, you know, to be able to build something for themselves. But as far as, like, you know, a builder coming in and saying, I'm going to build a, you know, 10 acres of affordable homes, not going to happen. I just don't see it.
Yeah. So what are you seeing the build costs right now run? So, like, per square foot, just with average finishes, are we at 150, 160 a square foot, minus the land, minus the permits, minus all the red tape and bureaucracy, just from a materials and labor costs? What are we looking at right now?
Shit. I don't know. I mean, I wish I had an answer for you on that, because right now I couldn't tell you.
Do you think 150 is a reasonable number, though?
That doesn't seem unreasonable to me at all.
Yeah, 150. So just thinking this through, if someone wanted to build their own home, and again, this is minus the land costs and minus the permits and whatnot, and this is obviously going to be a heck of a lot easier once you get outside of the city limits. So we're talking about more of a kind of a rural place. This would be very difficult to do in Portland. And I know that from experience, because I built a home from the ground up right by Mount Tabor, and kind of right there in, you know, the eastern side of Portland. So you don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. The average person, there's no way. Even if they knew how to build a house with their own, you know, bare hands or do the subs, there's no way they could have done that, because the city made me jump through so many hoops to get that done, to the point of having to literally pave the road in front of the house in order to get the permit to build. I mean, it just got completely ridiculous. I had to put in basically anything that the city is supposed to do to maintain the road, I had to do. They basically blackmailed me in order to get me to do all the improvements that they didn't have the tax money for, because they were squandering it somewhere else just to get the permit. I mean, it was just a joke. They just held that carrot in front of the horse for so long. But anyway, I don't want to go off on that tangent. If you're able to build maybe out in a more rural area, it's something that you could do. So if you've got 150 per square foot, if you've got 1,000 square foot house, then you're looking at 150 grand. So, you know, with everything involved, you might be able to get that done for, let's say, $200,000. The next question that would be interesting is, I wonder how easily you could get a loan for that, though. I don't know if there'd be a lending appetite for just going out and buying all the materials yourself and building it. I don't think that could go through Fannie and Freddie. Maybe I'm wrong. But if it can't go through Fannie and Freddie, then that's going to be a big hurdle there as well.
Well, I think you could probably, after the house was constructed, to be able to refinance through.
Yeah, you know, right. There you go.
You can get a construction loan, get the house built, and then refinance into something different.
But, yeah. So, yeah. If you get that.
You know, because I think about it. Yeah, I think about it a lot. Like, you know, I, you know, just like sometimes I just think about some of the things that I've heard. Like, you know, I mean, how many times in construction have you heard somebody say, hey, go down and grab a dozen 2x48s, you know, for bracing or something like that? That's $100 bill. Yeah, that's $100 bill to go buy a dozen 2x4s right now. I don't know how many people are interested in building at like that. I mean, there's some people who might have this dream about doing it, but then they have the money, you know. But as far as like, say, a young couple wanting to build their dream home or something, or get a starter home built or build their first home, mm-hmm. I would feel for those guys who are taking on that project right now.
You know, so what do you think the release valve is? I mean, we've got this situation where, let's just say, materials are going to come down to where they were pre-COVID, but we still have the issue of regulations and the extremely expensive land because of these zoning laws and whatnot. And if you what I use in the video, you just look at LA and you compare it to Houston. You know, so many people think that the reason that housing prices are so high in California is because everyone makes so much money, and that, you know, all these millionaires come in and they drive up the prices, and therefore none of the middle class can afford more because of this gentrification. And that's not entirely true, because you've got a place like Houston where the incomes are very close to what they are in some place like LA, but you can rent a reasonable house in Houston for, let's say, $1,000 a month, where in LA, you're not going to get anything for under $2,500 or $3,000 a month. And the average home cost price in Houston might be, let's call it $220,000, where in LA, it's going to be $600,000. You know, so that's a big, the regulations are huge there. But let's just say that materials kind of go back down to where they were, but we can't get rid of these building codes and these regulations and all these hurdles that make it so expensive. What's the release valve? What's the end game there for the average family that, let's say, is making $60,000-$75,000 a year, and they can't afford a $400,000 house? What are their options look like here in 10 years?
Well, in 10 years, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's like, it's hard to predict the future, but it is, as far as I can see things, I think people are holding on to houses because the prices are so high. I think there's people who own multiple homes. I know of quite a few houses here in the Astoria area that nobody lives in. They're like weekend houses and stuff like that. Mm. People like owning homes right now because they can get the cash out of them when the prices go up. So, like, there's no downside to trying to own real estate. When those prices churn at some point, like, interest rates have to go up just a little bit and we'd see the housing market come back down. Those foreclosures need to come on the market. We're going to start seeing houses prices come down as these, you know, once foreclosures start flooding in, and now you got people who are competing with foreclosed homes, they don't want to see the price of their value of their homes go down. So they're going to put them on the market too and try and sell them out. So I could see like prices dropping, causing prices to drop.
Great point.
You know, because, you know, just like anything, you know, you want to get out of the stock market at the high, you know, buy low, sell high. And, you know, when you got prices as high as they are, you know, like the other, when everybody's talking a lot about silver right now, and I'm like, man, it's at $23. Remember when it was at 15? You know, wouldn't you rather be buying at 15 than 23? Like 23 doesn't really interest me. 15 interests me on silver. You know, I want to buy low. And, you know, I don't want to necessarily be in the move. I just want to be in the right spot at the right time. And I think a lot of people who own homes, if they, like, you know, start seeing their houses, like the value of their houses dropping $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, and they're like, okay, let's get rid of this thing.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I didn't really address that in my video. I should have. I'm going to have to do a follow-up video to that. But also, too, we've got this situation where private equity funds and hedge funds like BlackRock own so much of the housing stock. And obviously they're keeping it because they can't get a better return anywhere else. But if we did have interest rates go up, especially like on the 10-year, the risk-free rate goes up to, I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but, you know, 6-7%, something like that. These big, huge funds like BlackRock could rotate out of housing into 10-year or XYZ asset class. And that rotation could create a massive amount of supply hitting the market at the same time.
I didn't even think about that. I was thinking about the individual. I wasn't thinking about the private equity guys, you know, but you're right. I mean, they own so much of it. It could be huge swaths of houses coming on the market as they're like, hey, we need to reposition our money.
Yeah, you know, I was in St. Bart's for the last 3 months or so, and basically you got this super small Caribbean island with about 9,000 people on it, and it's all just hedge fund managers and billionaires and investment bankers and all these guys. So I met a lot of interesting people. We had some great conversations there. But one of the dinner parties I went to, I was talking to a hedge fund guy who's currently a hedge fund guy. And we were talking about real estate and how great of an asset class it is. And I was talking to him about when I retired in 2012 and I got into real estate by going into the Midwest and buying some homes. You know, most people that watch my channel know that story quite well. And I went pretty much all in with everything I had in real estate in 2012 with these ranch homes, you know, 1,200 square foot. And buying them from the bank and fixing them up and keeping them in a rental portfolio or selling them. And so I was talking about this with this hedge fund guy. He's like, yep, exactly. He's like, that is spot on. He goes, that's exactly what I was doing in 2011 and 2012 as well. I'm like, oh, wow, man, that's kind of coincidental. You know, tell me about it. We're sitting there having a beer. And he's like, yeah, I bought some homes in Florida and I bought a few in Vegas and a few in Phoenix. I said, okay, great. And I didn't really want to push it any further than that. But then we had a couple more beers and someone else came into the conversation. And that other person inquired about, well, okay, you bought a few homes. What's a few? Because I said that I bought a few homes, right? And so I'm thinking, you say a few. So you're thinking your few is similar to his few. And the
other five, you know.
What's that?
A few, like five, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for me, that's like 5, 6, 10, you know, something like that. Right. And he said, what's a few for this guy? He's like, it was right around 4,000.
Jesus. I can't even, like, I just have a hard time even, like, understanding, like, that much, you know.
Yeah, but my whole point here is not to really tell a story about St. Bart's, but it's to show the listener and the viewer that these, and that this was just an individual hedge fund guy. This is not BlackRock. This right. is not one of the big players. If you think, and they own that housing stock too. Now I'm really thinking this through, because the houses they bought weren't the big McMansions. They were the stereotypical rental property that they're going to buy for, let's call it, you know, back then $100,000, maybe now $150,000, maybe $200,000. They're going to be able to get a good RV ratio on, rent to value ratio, just like I look for and just like my buddy Jason Hartman looks at. So that this is the housing stock, the quote unquote affordable housing that we need. These big funds own it, and we could see a rotation that would bring a lot of supply. So that's another cross current that I think people really need to think about. That's definitely my next real estate video, for sure.
All right on, man. Yeah, very cool.
So I know you're running short on time. You got to get to work here. But I really would love to hear your thoughts on where we're going with the inflation, deflation debate. You know, that's been going back and forth on Twitter. And then gold, silver, Bitcoin. I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
So I'm still in the idea that we still have about a deflation, in the midst. And I know that's really hard for a lot of people to try and, try and think of, considering how much the Federal Reserve has been putting on their balance sheet and trying to inject into the economy and stuff.
Do you see that because of the demand side?
I see it from the demand side. I see, like, and I really see it not just from the United States, but really from the globe, you know, at some point as things deteriorate, the demand for dollars is going to be far bigger than anybody had ever anticipated.
Okay.
During that initial, it won't last forever, and then that'll turn and eventually go into a hyperinflation scenario. But before that happens, I think there's going to be, you know, before the hyperinflation, there's going to be a deflationary scenario that is going to force the Federal Reserve to take into action something that they had never done before. And that's introduce that Fed coin, that cryptocurrency, right. The central bank digital currency.
Yep.
And there, you know, it's funny because I talked about this a while ago and people just said I was crazy. It's never going to happen, but it's really, really coming into gear now.
Yep.
And what was that? Loretta Mester had a great speech. Couple like last week or something like that, where she talked all about the central bank digital currency, and it's pretty much what it's going to be. It's going to be direct injections of money into our digital wallets that we can spend into the economy. Now, right now, there is no legal authority, I guess, to say for the Fed to do it. It's not in their charter to be able to hand money directly over to the people. So they're going to need a crisis to deal with that in order to get Congress to change the laws for them to be able to provide everybody with these digital wallets and then be able to inject that money directly into our digital wallets so that we can go and spend it into the economy. Once that happens, then we are going to start seeing inflation and money velocity and everything else start picking up. Yeah. But as long as they're continuing to loan the money into the system and the interest rates being as low as they are and the return on the investment being pretty much nil, I just don't see the money velocity picking up during that time. That's just my opinion on it. Of course, you know, I mean, I just pick up bits and pieces of information from everybody. I'm not educated in the matter by any means, but it just certainly seems to be the case that's coming up. I mean, I don't think the Federal Reserve would be putting as much effort towards the digital currency and injecting money directly into the system through those digital wallets if they did not feel that there is going to be a crisis coming into the future that they need the tools ready to enact. And they can see it happening in the next couple of years. They say by 2023, I think it's going to happen sooner than that. But I think everything happens sooner than it does. You know, I always think everything's happening like way quick. And this is a very slow, you know.
Well, at the end of the day, they have to have inflation to bail out the government. Because, you know, we're $26, $27 trillion in debt. And we've got $4 trillion deficits annually right now. The only way out there is some serious, serious inflation. And I would assume the Fed is looking at Japan and saying, okay, well, what happened in Japan? Why could they not get inflation? And therefore, how can we get inflation if we want it? And it goes right back to everyone having an account with the Fed where they just turn bank reserves into legal tender, just like Dr. Lacey Hump would say, and it's exactly what you just outlined. So how does that work for gold, silver, and Bitcoin?
In my opinion, that would be like very good for gold and silver, and Bitcoin as well. I'm very fond of Bitcoin. I like Bitcoin. I try and buy some every once in a while just to keep adding to it. I like the system and the way it works. I'm not completely sold on the idea that Bitcoin is going to be like the next currency of the future. I don't see it going anywhere. I like Bitcoin because of the security behind it. You know, there's more mining going behind Bitcoin than any other. So there's a lot of reasonings why I like the Bitcoin protocol. I personally am more into Litecoin. I like the founder, Charlie Lee, the guy who came up with Litecoin. Right. A lot of people don't like him for some of the decisions he made, but I really like, you know, his nature. I really like the effort that he puts into his project and his coin. So I kind of go with Litecoin myself, right, just because I picked one a long time ago and that was it. So I see like cryptocurrencies having a future. Which one? I couldn't tell you. Blockchain, for sure. Blockchain is definitely going to come into the system. Everybody's going to be, everybody and everything is eventually going to get tokenized. And I know that's scary for some people to hear, but it's just going to be the case. A friend of mine didn't even realize it, that he was buying a service using a cryptocurrency and a blockchain technology. He didn't even realize he was doing it. His friend was setting him up with this particular service. I don't want to talk too much about it because I really don't know a whole lot about it. And then I don't know if they want me talking about it anyway, but I'm going to. So, but he was buying this particular service and he says, hey man, there's this way you can get a discount if you use this other operation in order to pay instead of using PayPal. He said, fine, let's use the other operation. Well, it turned out to be Uniswap was this coin that he was using. Well, he got airdropped like 400 Uniswap worth $2,200. And he was like, man, I can't believe it. I just don't even know. I mean, now what is this? You know? And so I had to explain to him blockchain and cryptocurrencies and wallets and everything else. But he cashed out half of it for $1,100. He was still beside himself, you know, that he was able to do this. And so this blockchain technology is incorporating itself into everything and into our lives. And a lot of people, like I said, are not going to even realize that it happened. Yeah. And there. As far as gold and silver, I save in silver. That's like, if I'm going to put any money into savings, you know, as far as like my long-term, never touch it again savings, I buy silver bullion every time.
At any price.
And yeah, pretty much at any price. At this point, it's any price because I've been buying since 2009. I've bought it at $35 an ounce and I bought it at $15 an ounce. And I couldn't tell you where my average is. So I guess it doesn't matter at this point. It's just about how many ounces I have. And not really, because I couldn't tell you what my average is anymore. It's just, right. I bought so much all over the place. Yeah.
So you just see gold and silver as a store of value. And that you're really not speculating on it. You just buy it because it's always going to maintain its purchasing power over the long run.
Pretty much. It's been my foundation. Like, it's what gets me to sleep at night, you know? I don't know if I told you the story, but I was broke as hell a few years back. And I mean, heavily in debt and had broken down cars and all kinds of stuff, you know? And it was just like, it sucks being in that position, like where you don't even have enough money to like, go buy toilet paper. Like, you don't have any money. You spend all the change. It's all gone. But I had an ammo box full of silver and life wasn't so bad. You know, like you had it, you knew it, that it was there and that, you know, you had that protection, that insurance. And so like, you know, you show up to work, you get your next paycheck, you blast through that one, you just keep doing it. And then pretty soon, you know, you keep adding to it and you realize you go back and it was just like, man, thank God I had that silver. Cause if I didn't have that, I really would not have been able to sleep. You know, I would have been stressed out to the max and stuff. So to me, like, it's out of the banking system. It's away from everybody. It's something I can give to my kids, you know, later. It's, to me, it's like, it's my base. It's like my foundations, what I build everything off of.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what it's all about. That's what precious metals at their core, that's the reason you own them right there. And that's a great story. Yeah.
Had you asked me 10 years ago when I first started buying and it ran up to $50 an ounce, I would have told you I was the smartest person in the world and everybody should have listened to me and I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to have like brand new cars and houses, guys watch and see. So I learned a lot. I learned my lesson from that when it went from, you know, after spending, you know, $35 an ounce, watching it go all the way down to, you know, less than 15, you know, you learn a lot. You learn a lot from that, you know? Yeah. And so I don't take the same perspective that I used to, you know, especially when it comes to silver.
Yeah, it can be volatile. You have to look at it over the long run. It's maintaining its purchasing power. All right, man, I know you've got to go here. I could talk to you all day long. But for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, the YouTube channel, you even got your own merchandise right now. I mean, my goodness, we could get an uneducated economist hoodie. We can get mugs. We can get everything. I think everyone needs to go out and get themselves a hoodie right now as soon as this video gets done. But where can they go to check out more?
Uneducated Economist on YouTube. It's where I'm most active. I do have Twitter, Facebook, Patreon, but pretty much I'm most active on YouTube. Like I do, I have a day job, so I try and, you know, fill in my time with YouTube and stuff like that. And I try and answer as many comments and emails. But if you wanted to get some merchandise, if you go to my YouTube channel, scroll down into the description, you'll find a link to Teespring down there. It will take you to all the merchandise. It was pretty fun. I had a customer come into the place where I worked the other day and he like, hey, dude. He held up his shirt and he had the Uneducated Economist. Like, hey, right on. So he's talking about that. With that. I thought, man, that is awesome. I can't wait to see something like that just out of random again, you know, see somebody wearing my shirt.
So. That is so cool. Very cool. And I can't encourage people enough to go to your channel and check it out. Because if you like today's conversation, you are going to love Mr. Economist's channel, because he talks about this stuff all the time, not just lumber prices, but just the boots on the ground stuff that no one else is talking about. We can sit there and talk about the repo market and, you know, all the stuff I talk about with Snyder and Grohman and Lynn Alden and all these people, but it's very kind of high level stuff, but rarely do you get the opportunity to hear what's happening on the ground. And that's where you come in and you just, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with some people that manage quite a bit of money, and a lot of them watch your channel. And they're they tell me, like, George, I don't know if you've ever heard of this uneducated economist guy. You really need to check his stuff out, man. I've been watching it. It gives me great insight. So everyone watching now needs to go to your channel and subscribe.
I appreciate it, you know, and it's true, man. I mean, some people, they tell me, there's like, hey, I work for this hedge fund, or I work for this money man. And sometimes I wonder, it's like, man, do they really, you know, and I look where the email's from and I'm like, wow, man, these guys really are listening. I guess they really like that street level perspective. And
absolutely,
that is what I try. You know, I think of my channel more as the comments. Like, the comment section is really where the gold of my channel is. I put a video out, I think of a good topic that I think people would want to have a conversation about. I put out my opinion, you know, the thoughts that I have on it. I put some links into the description. But then when the comments start coming in, that's really where the gold is. And you get so many ideas and so many perspectives, and, you know, people share their thoughts and links, and just, it's great. I mean, it's a wonderful chance to learn a lot about economics. We talk in as down to earth and layman's terms. We don't try and fill it in with jargon and stuff, you know. And if there is something with jargon, we try to explain the jargon so that we can understand it a little bit better. Yeah, it's a wonderful channel for just for gaining knowledge and learning and stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
I've enjoyed it. I never would have expected it to grow this big, George. I never did, you know. So, you know, sitting here in, you know, in the morning, it's just totally makes my day, man, you know.
So. Yeah, well, I sure enjoy talking to you, man. I cannot wait to do it again. I hope you enjoy your day at work, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.